We now call the first case of the morning, United States against Weiss. Counsel for the defense.
May it please the court, my name is Captain Sean Mangan, and I, along with Lieutenant Colonel Stephen Hendricks, represent the appellant in this case, Private James Weiss. The placement of an American soldier with enemy prisoners is a violation of Article 12. But the placement of an American soldier with enemy prisoners in a foreign combat area, in an EPW cage temporary makeshift facility meant to hold those suspected of being threats to American personnel in the United States, and the placement of that soldier in double irons for the duration of his stay, or who is given no means to conduct any personal hygiene for the duration of his stay, where he is not released from his double irons for the duration of his stay, where he is given only the single meal pack of his food with no utensils for the duration of his stay, and where there is no means for him to interact with the chaplain or his attorney or to file any grievance, is more than a mere violation of Article 12. It is a violation of Article 55 of the UCMJ and is a violation of the Eighth Amendment because it's cruel and unusual punishment. This court analyzes Article 55 violations much in the same way, using the framework that the Supreme Court has handed down for its Eighth Amendment violations, because they basically address the same issue, cruel and unusual punishment. And as such, this court has routinely drawn from Supreme Court precedent and rules and analysis in examining whether or not a particular punishment is cruel and unusual.
How do we know in this context whether the use of irons was necessary for safe custody?
That's a very good question.
Who has the burden of determining, establishing that?
Well, certainly the appellant brings the burden forward to raise that, and the appellant's proof in arguing that that is unnecessary, and if I may, Your Honor, it brings an important point that was about what I was get to in the criminal unusual analysis. Certainly the Eighth Amendment framework is useful for this court and on point. But because Article 55 is unique to military punishment and in the past has addressed issues that are unique to the military, such as provisions of bread and water on ships, there are times when this court's issues may address things specific. And Article 55's specific mention or prohibition of the use of irons, double or single, except for the purposes of safe custody, is such an area where we're dealing now with something which is unique to UCMJ statutory protections rather than a straight Eighth Amendment cruel and unusual punishment analysis. Now, the question, of course, is it necessary to have someone in double irons? Is there a possible time when someone can be kept in handcuffs and shackles for an extended period and there would not be a violation of Article 55? Certainly, Your Honor, that's possible. Of course, the government's response to this in their brief was to simply say, well, he was confined in a fully deployed area, therefore, it's reasonable for...
Well, they say, presumably, double irons were necessary for appellant safe custody, as this was not a conventional facility.
And absolutely.
Okay, what's your response to that?
I would say, first of all, that's an understatement of the year to say it's not a conventional facility. It's not a facility designed to hold American soldier at all. It's an EPW collection point. It's not where American soldier belongs. But furthermore, let's consider this.
Well, that's a separate line argument. We're talking irons here for the moment.
Well, the facility that they justify the use of double irons for is that...
Are you saying they shouldn't be in the same facility?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. And I'll say this. The placement of American... In analyzing whether or not they should be in the facility falls under the framework, Farm v. Brennan, that's been adopted and used by this court in White, as to whether or not there's an objectively serious act in a culpable state of mind. As far as his placement in an EPW facility and his totality and circumstances of his treatment while he's in that EPW facility, addresses the totality of circumstances objectively serious act. However, we believe that the Article 55's explicit prohibition on irons is also can be considered as part of that totality of circumstances.
All right, let's get to the answer to the question.
Absolutely, Your Honor. The placement of someone in double irons for the purpose of safe custody would mean that he needed those irons, otherwise he might escape. This court has never defined safe custody. The word safe custody has appeared 17 times in military case law, always as a footnote to other cruel and unusual punishment, never been defined. But we can accept that this court's plain reading of safe custody is that he would be immediately kept double irons to protect himself and those around him that had been made.
What factors in this case from this record should we look at to determine whether it was necessary to keep him in safe custody?
We would first point to the fact that there were 150 other individuals in the same facility that were not placed in double or single irons, and they were kept in safe custody. Therefore, the necessity to place this particular individual in safe custody seems very odd, especially because those other 150 individuals are natives that can have friends on the outside and could escape and disappear. An American running around into Crete is probably not a likely successful escape candidate. He is inside a facility where the guards speak his language, where he has no friends on the outside. He's a hostile combatant. He is more likely to stay in safe custody and the protection of American forces than those who are being kept around him who are not in double irons. Therefore, it seems very puzzling as to why you would place this American in double irons.
He's in double irons, and what's your statement of the record as to how he is safe and protected from the EPWs?
It is the logical inference of the appellant's position that his affidavit clearly states that he's being kept in an EPW facility, and his status as American is demarcated by a single strand of concertina wire drawn around his area. And we're outside that area in the remainder of this facility. There are 100 to 150 suspected enemy personnel.
So if he gets jumped, the thing that's protecting him is the concertina wire?
Yeah, if you want to call it that. I mean, it would be like saying, Your Honor, that I am not in the same facility as you and I'm protected if you strung a single piece of concertina wire around this podium and the rest of the people in this room were hostile and viewed the Americans as the enemy or potential enemy. And that turns to the next issue, which is the only real factual discussion that takes place between the two briefs, and that is this the same facility or is this not? I think it's pretty clear from the reading of the affidavits that it's the same facility, but in the government's brief, they allege that he is moving next door to or adjacent to a separate facility.
Was that the test, same facility?
No, I think it's an issue, the only factual issue, and that's why I address it, Your Honor.
Counsel, as I read the government's brief, it appears that every factual issue is in dispute here.
Well, I don't think that there's any factual dispute that he was kept in double irons or that he was held in a facility in Tikrit or that there were or the majority of the facts laid out in his affidavit are disputed.
Where would you say that the government concedes that any of that is true? As I read their brief, the government on page 5 contends that the record as a whole shows that appellant's assertions are not credible. So it appears to me we have a situation in which the government has made two arguments here. The first, disputing the facts, and second, saying if the facts are true, then as a matter of law, relief isn't warranted. And you're addressing the second.
You're right, Your Honor. In the response, the government cites two of the 16 principles, or GIN principles, one being that if we are all in agreement and there's no violation, then obviously no relief is warranted. And the other being, if we accept everything on its face and yet it is wholly disbelievable, then it's inappropriate for this court to grant relief.
Now, one of the approaches that we've taken in the issues of confinement conditions and cruel and unusual punishment is to require exhaustion of remedies with a very narrow exception. What's your understanding of the purpose of that exhaustion requirement?
Well, it is my understanding that this court has specifically stated that the reason we require exhaustion of administrative remedies is twofold. One is to allow prison officials to remedy ongoing violations of conditions, and the other is to build a sufficient record such that if judicial intervention is appropriate, that the best information may be made available to the court.
So that on the second point, if exhaustion hasn't taken place and there's not an excuse for it, it does give us pause, does it not, as to the credibility of the facts?
Understandably so. Had a better facts or better record be developed before this court, that certainly would be desirable. However, Your Honor, the fact remains that we have an American soldier who's alleging that he was in a place where he had no means to exhaust administrative remedies or build a record. He had no access to counsel. He had no access to anyone.
The date that he was placed in confinement was December 16th, 2003. Is that the date?
I believe so, Your Honor.
Okay. And the date of his submission to the convening authority appears to be January 1st, 2004.
Yes.
Fairly close in time.
For the level 5 matters, correct.
Right. And is there any reason why in the 1105 matters he would not have made a submission to the convening authority? Now, this is a very nicely typed document that he submitted here, saying, oh, by the way, here's what happened to me while I was in confinement after my trial, and I'd like credit for that.
Your Honor, certainly, as this court has recognized, the best time, sometimes the best chance for relief happens at that stage of a court-martial proceeding, and that's certainly would have been a great possibility. But like all violations, particularly those that deal with the touch on constitutional issues, such as this Eighth Amendment issue, the mere fact that an appellate failed or was not savvy enough or realized the value of raising an issue through counsel to the convening authority should not foreclose the ability for this court to take appropriate action to protect those rights.
And then on February 6th, his counsel submits a clemency matters to the convening authority, and again, this isn't mentioned. So when do we have the first time in which any submission is made to a person in authority as to the factual circumstances?
I would submit to the court that first attempt to reach a person of authority was made prior to his placement in the EPW cage. If you turn to appellant's second affidavit, you'll see that his command sergeant major and he working through his reserve battalion, which was attached to this infantry task force, requested that he be properly confined in the unit area and then shipped to the Kuwait temporary holding facility before he should have been fully properly moved on.
What record do we have to establish that as a fact?
You are left only with the affidavit.
Okay. Well, I'm talking about at what point do we have a complaint by this individual that's documented in the record of the proceedings?
Well, certainly reporting the absence of that documentation, Your Honor. And
is the affidavit the first point?
It is, Your Honor.
Okay. And what's the date of the affidavit that you're relying on here?
Well, they're both references are made. The first affidavit is dated, was admitted by the Army Court. It was made in August of 2004. And then his later affidavit was made and admitted by this court was made in September of 2006.
Okay, so we've got more than 8 months passed before he's placed anything in writing.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you.
And perhaps the point that needs to be made here is that as Article 55 often deals with things which are specific and unique to the military, so too the analysis of this court should be specific and unique to military conditions and the circumstances faced.
Speaking of that, so what are the conditions in decreed and what notice, if any, should we take of them? Do they have to be established in the record or can we assume knowledge based on what we might think about decreed in December of 2003?
I think that that this court's heard enough and knows enough about the general conditions of the state of Iraq that it doesn't require specific documentation about the general state of where the war was at that point and what decreed Iraq is. And certainly, though, I understand the court's desire to have the most facts available for specific things related to this claim and this particular facility. And I understand the court is left only with those made in the affidavits. However, keep in mind, if the court would please keep in mind, part of the frustration and challenge with this claim is that an American soldier, one who's probably better equipped and most savvy and able to make utilization of the system to build an effective record to give to this court, is placed in a facility where no such system exists. It is not an American facility. It's not a system made to hold American soldiers in post-trial confinement. He's thrown an EPW collection cage. He can't build a record for this court.
Well, we only know that from his affidavit.
And of course, Your Honor, how else would you know it? There's no other possible way.
Well, again, On January 1st, 2004, there's a document, and it is nicely typed from him, from Camp Spiker, Iraq. And then in February of 2004, there's a very other nicely typed document from his defense counsel from the Tikrit Field Office. Nice stationery. It's got all the headings that you would find on a document as if it was typed here at Fort McNair. Why should we assume that he's in conditions that are any different from the conditions that he would face in any other post-trial confinement facility in terms of access to defense counsel and opportunity for defense counsel to make a submission?
Well, the fact that his defense counsel has access to a computer and can type type documents for him to sign or otherwise prepare, you know, things on letterhead doesn't speak to the conditions, the facility in which he may have stayed for a week.
Doesn't it speak to his access to defense counsel, the appellant's access to defense counsel and his opportunity to communicate to defense counsel?
Maybe I'm not making this clear, Your Honor. There's no allegation that after his time in the EPW cage, he had access again to his defense counsel later, but at that point, the stay was over. I'm not saying that he was given access to his defense counsel while he was in the cage. If you look, his affidavit never alleges that.
I understand that, but since he had an opportunity on defense counsel stationery to make a submission on January 1st, 2004, hard upon this period upon which he complains. Why can't we look at that and presume that he had an opportunity to consult with defense counsel and make any complaint that he needed to make at that point? And if he didn't make that complaint at that point, why can't we take that into account in determining under Ginn whether the record on its state, on its face, is credible?
I will answer that in two parts because you asked basically two questions. First of all, it is, can you presume that he had that opportunity? Absolutely. You can easily come to the conclusion that he had access to counsel and had the opportunity to make clemency submissions under 1105. But the second part of your question, whether or not that should be a basis for you to disbelieve the totality of his complaint or somehow undercut the credibility of his affidavits, you should not. And the reason for that being is there's nothing in it. You have the mere absence of this whole line of discussion in those 1105 submissions. The 1105 submissions are silent on the matter. Certainly, the court should take that into account that he failed to exhaust that particular
issue. And isn't that the second point of the exhaustion requirement, that the absence of a complaint is a significant factor to be taken into account as to the credibility of the later allegation?
And to that I would respond, Your Honor, the two mechanisms that this court routinely turns to as exhaustion of administrative remedies and the logic behind it, which we previously discussed here today, is not tied with 1105 submissions. 1105 submissions, well, they may have benefited.
Don't focus on 1105. There's good reasons why you don't want to complain about not getting your MRE dessert when you're writing to a combat commander about clemency in a combat zone.
Yes, Your Honor.
You might want to emphasize the nature of your service. But if you've got access to someone who can type this stuff up and do all this, perhaps they could have written something else, is the point. Not the 1105. You're not going to whine to the battalion commander or whomever about your food in an 1105, maybe, but why not send a different note to a different person or to the same person complaining about the conditions of your confinement?
And perhaps appellant at this point, if you look at his second affidavit, believed that he, and again, we here in this courtroom today have full benefit knowledge of what potential means he may have had access to or can speculate about that, Your Honor. But he, as you look at his affidavit, when he did arrive at the facility in Kuwait, he found that there was a grievance system in place because it was a facility made to hold American prisoners. And he then approached, you see the second affidavit, he approached the guard force and asked what he could do about his Kuwait stay and was told there was nothing he could have done at that point. And it is a logical inference for that he may have believed in the guard force that he could not raise the issue. And certainly that should not be held against him if he is attempting to exhaust the remedies in place or exhaust assistance in place in Kuwait and find out what options he has about what happened in Iraq and is told that's a different command, that's over, and isn't able to do anything about it, that he would then not pursue it.
What was the date on which he was told that?
I would place it about 4 days into his stay in Kuwait. If you look at his affidavit, he initially was processed into the Kuwait, the Camp F. John Holden facility. He was placed in a 72-hour hold, which is part of the normal processing there.
What date would that be?
January, or it would be before the submission dates that you referenced before, if that's the point we're trying to reach.
Where is he on January 1st?
I believe he is in Kuwait at that point, Your Honor. He is.
So if he's in Kuwait and he's submitted a document with stationery that says Iraq, telephone conversation and having the defense counsel type this up? What reasonable inference can we draw from that?
Because the documentation is prepared, all his matters are prepared by, there's two things you can draw from that. One, if you look at the rest of his first affidavit about the state of that facility, the post-trial confinement facility and holding facility in Kuwait, that facility is in its infancy and is a very rough facility. And if I may, just while we're talking about this, I mean, certainly the government's going to say, raise the point today, and we're going to talk about today, his conditions, and say he's in a field environment. The whole of this argument is what's important, where he's confined, how he's kept in double irons, who he's with, and how he's treated. The fact alone that he may be in a place that has rugged conditions does not, certainly not the basis for our claim. Now, however, those rugged conditions are certainly present in theater at this time, and from his affidavit, it appears that the Kuwait facility has those rugged conditions. Certainly, it does not appear a reasonable reading of that he would have access to type the document that you see dated January 1st. More reasonable, however, is that he has contact with his defense counsel and has a duty to help him prepare his 1105, 1106 submissions and helps him and assists him preparing that, since that is the individual, that counsel, his individual is going to ultimately collect that and submit it for him to the convening authority for 1105 submissions. So, looking at the whole of the granted limited information provided by the affidavit, you see that there's no likelihood that he's going to have access to create that document that you see in that facility.
Do we know when the Tikrit field office was set up? We know it was set up as of 6 February, but do we know when, does the record reflect when it was set up?
It does not, Your Honor.
Counsel, in view of this court's decision in Lovett, how do you establish deliberate indifference on the part of the confinement officials?
There are two arguments that we offer for that, and one is that you must have some objective knowledge of what standards are. You must have standards before you can hold someone and say they're violating the standards. Fortunately, confinement of American post-trial confinees is well regulated in AR 190-47, and for that reason, we place in our brief some of the provisions that would be relevant to the commanders and their legal staff as to how they should treat post-trial confinees. But more importantly, and more to the point, there had to be a decision to place this individual in the EPW facility as opposed to someplace else. And that decision, turning again to the second affidavit of appellant, where his chain of command, a military police unit, we could expect to be savvy to the requirements and handling of both EPWs and American soldiers in confinement, offered to properly hold him and not place him in EPWs, and that there were concerns about placing him in EPWs, and they disregarded that counsel from the subordinate commander and placed him in there anyway.
Well, the requirements of Article 12 don't prohibit placement of American prisoners with EPWs in the same facility. It prohibits them being in the immediate association.
That's absolutely correct.
Couldn't that be in the same facility if there is sufficient separation?
I would say that certainly there doesn't seem to be sufficient separation if he's able to have one-on-one conversation with individuals who he formerly guarded and walked up and talked to him, and that he's wearing the same uniform that the EPWs are being held in, and that they are all around him. It would be like saying that I'm not being held in direct association with the other individuals in this room if he's strung along with concertina wire around his podium.
But the affidavit doesn't indicate, other than the EPWs that were put into quarantine, doesn't indicate any space delineation between the EPWs and himself.
Well, he said that all separated him as a single strand of concertina wire.
Well, that's what's separating him, but it doesn't tell you how much area there is between where he is, the concertina wire, and the EPWs.
Well, he did state that they are free to roam throughout the area, so we can assume that they can walk right up to the concertina wire. In fact, I think he stated they could walk right up to the concertina wire and attempt to engage in a conversation.
Well, what if it's 40 feet away?
Well, I think that if we're getting into a factual dispute as to that, then perhaps it's the best interest of this court to seek further factual through a factual hearing. But I think that in reality, we see that there's a facility with holding 100, 150 people. Inside that facility, there's a little ring of concertina wire, and there's the American in the middle. Frankly, Private Wise is very lucky that he didn't wake up with his throat cut.
Is it your position that a violation of Article 12 is a sufficiently serious act?
It is.
Per se, is that a per se sufficiently serious act?
We would, Your Honor, and we would say that it is a violation of Article 12. It is a sufficiently serious act to begin the two-part analysis, and certainly a violation of Article 12 may still survive the Article 55 analysis if you don't have a sufficiently culpable state of mind. I think that that's the two-part test that this court is stuck with.
Do you have to speculate at all to conclude that there was deliberate indifference on the part of the confinement officials?
When looking at the decision in light of the alternative to place him somewhere where he's not exposed to EPWs, not left in this facility in double irons, but to be properly confined in his unit area, which was the proposal by his unit, then you see that deliberate indifference without speculation.
Well, we don't know what those alternatives are.
You are left again with the affidavit, which states that this is what was being discussed with his chain of command, his command sergeant major at the time.
Thank you.
I see that I have 1 minute left, so I'm going to go ahead and set up. Certainly,
I think your time has expired, but you'll have an opportunity during rebuttal.
And for that reason, we ask the court to give appropriate relief. Thank you, Your
Honor. Counsel for the government.
May it please the court. I am Captain Andrew Baum, along with Colonel John Miller II. We represent the United States government in this matter. The appellate filings in the record compellingly demonstrate the improbability of appellant's claims. The appellant has failed to show that his confinement conditions in Tikrit were objectively sufficiently serious. He has failed to prove that prison officials had a culpable state of mind amounting to deliberate indifference to his health or safety, and he has failed to exhaust his administrative remedies. And for these reasons, this honorable court should affirm the Army Court's ruling.
Now, are you in agreement that the record we're dealing with here are essentially the two affidavits?
Yes, Your Honor. The record consists solely of two affidavits.
Well, and the clemency submissions, the pieces of paper, are they, you understand they're not part of the record?
They are part of the record, Your Honor. Yes, they are included. And that brings me to the first part of the government's argument. Under the fourth Ginn principle, this court should deny the appellant the relief he requests because the record and the filings compellingly demonstrate the improbability of those facts. A simple look at the timeline of events along this appellant's complaint and appeal shows the improbability. On 16 December 2003, the appellant was convicted and was sent to this facility at Tikrit. A week later, he was moved to Kuwait. On 1 January 2004...
So how does that compellingly show he wasn't in leg irons for the entire time he was wherever he was in Tikrit?
It doesn't compellingly show that he wasn't in leg irons.
You say in your brief that even if everything's true that he says, he's not entitled to relief. So let's say it's true he was in leg irons the entire time. Why does the record compellingly show that he's not entitled to relief or wasn't in leg irons or whatever your argument is?
Well, there's two parts of the government's argument there, Your Honor. The first part being that's an improbable because as the complaint and the appeal process goes on, the appellant's complaints get more and more egregious. A week and a half after he leaves Tikrit, he submits his clemency request written on trial defense letterhead. There's no mention of these supposed abhorrent conditions that he underwent. On 6 February 2004...
But where is he at that time?
He's in Kuwait, Your Honor.
Okay.
And a month and a half later, on 6 February 2004, his defense counsel submits the 1105 and 1106 matters. Again, there's no mention of these supposed abhorrent conditions. On 7 March of 2004, the convening authority takes action in this case. And on 4 June of 2004, the appellant's released to confinement. It's not until 9 August of 2004, 8 months after he leaves to CRIT, that the appellant first claims there was a violation of Article 55 of the Eighth Amendment. And that's in his first affidavit. On 3 December 2004, the appellant submitted his brief to the Army Court. And on 2 February of 2006, the appellant lost at the Army Court. The Army Court summarily affirmed the findings and conviction and sentence. And on 16 May of this year, of 2006, the appellant appealed to this court. And on 21 September of 2006, almost 3 years after he left to CRIT, the appellant files his second affidavit. And it's his second affidavit that contains the bulk of the alleged violations. Now, the second affidavit was submitted 2 years after his first affidavit, but it contains substantially more allegations. And there's some significant differences between the first and the second affidavit. First of all, the second affidavit contains the allegation that his battalion wanted to hold him in the unit area, but the brigade commander overruled. This is the first time that he mentions he didn't have contact with trial defense or his unit after he was placed in confinement into CRIT. This is the first time he claims that there was no normal in-processing procedures at the facility into CRIT.
What about his claims of being in association with EPWs and the leg iron bit? Are those only in the second affidavit, or are they in the first affidavit?
No, there is a thing that says he is in leg irons in the first affidavit. However, a key contradiction between the first and the second affidavit is that in the first affidavit, he says, I was given a jumpsuit to cover up my name and rank, presumably to protect him. However, in the second affidavit, he says, I was given the same jumpsuit that the EPWs were given. So now he's alleging in the second affidavit that this was done to punish him.
Do you think the gravamen of his complaint is that he didn't get his dessert and he didn't like his jumpsuit? Or do you think the gravamen of the complaint is the association with the EPWs and the leg irons?
From the appellant's argument, it sounds like it's the totality of the circumstances, Your Honor. So it's all these factors together are what caused this violation.
Could I encourage you to, at least for my benefit, to focus on the leg irons and the association and not the jumpsuit?
The key factor to look at with the hand and leg irons is, if you look, he says that he was confined with two other soldiers. Now, he never says whether or not these other two soldiers were in leg irons as well. And the key point to that being, Your Honor, he never says that I was in leg irons, but these two were not, and therefore I was treated differently. So he shows no proof. He does not meet that subjective prong showing the deliberate indifference on the part of prison officials to his health or safety. And he presents no evidence that he was put in hand and leg irons other than for safe custody. And it's his burden to do so, and he simply failed to do
so. Well, now, if, under Ginn, if we are taking his allegations as true that he was placed in leg irons, that he was double irons, at that point, isn't it the government's burden to show that that was for purposes of safe custody? He doesn't have to show that. All he has to do is show that he was in leg irons.
Well, no, Your Honor. According to United States versus Lovett, the burden is on appellant, because in Lovett, this court said that it's not going to speculate about what prison officials knew or didn't know, or that they knew about a risk and disregarded it. Lovett places that burden squarely on the appellant, and he's failed to meet that burden.
So we should assume that he was in a situation where officials found it necessary to have him in double irons for how long?
It would have been 7 days. He claims that he was in double irons while he was in
7 days.
Yes, Your Honor.
Based upon what practice of the United States Army should we assume that that's an appropriate form of confinement?
Well, first of all, as I said under Lovett, the court shouldn't speculate about what prison officials knew. However, this is a deployed environment. You don't have established facilities like you do in the United States. And the appellant has failed to show that I was locked in a cell, but I was also placed in leg irons, which is what he would need to do to show that there was this culpable state of mind.
How do we know that they didn't have established facilities? Let's take a look at the same documents we're looking at with the defense. We've got this nice Department of Defense stationery beautifully typed submissions here. Looks to me, from the face of the record that we have before us, that this was an environment in which people could operate as counsel and law enforcement people operate anywhere else under the UCMJ.
Well, what that shows is that they had computers and printers and the ability to type. What it doesn't show, unfortunately, Your Honor, is the conditions that existed. And just using common sense, this is the early stage of combat. this is not a place where you have established facilities like you do in the United States. It's simply a makeshift prison in a combat zone. Now, there is a certain baseline of treatment that soldiers that are confined should get, and the appellant was treated in accordance with that baseline. He was treated humanely. He never says
is it Army doctrine that in a combat zone in the early stages of deployment that double shackles and irons would be the standard procedure?
There's no Army doctrine to that effect, Your Honor. However, the regulation that the appellant cites states that there is an exception for a field expedient detention cell, and that's exactly what this was. And the standard in that is that it's got to reasonably meet all the conditions. It's got to, and this facility did meet that. The appellant was kept there.
This facility did meet this based on what part of the record? His affidavits, or what you said this facility met all the requirements?
Just
what part of the record are you citing to?
Just based solely on, if this court were to take the appellant's allegations as true, and the government's not saying that it should, but if it does, then if you simply look at appellant's affidavits, the appellant was kept in safe custody. The appellant never claims that he was thirsty. He never claims that he was hungry. He never claims he was in pain.
So you're accepting one strand of concertina wire between 150 EPWs who we don't know who they are, what they're up to, and a U.S. service member in shackles is safe custody?
Well, there's more than
in
that.
A combat zone?
There's more than that, Your Honor. The appellant mentions also in his affidavit that guards were around. He says, anytime I had to go to the bathroom, I would talk to the guards, and they would take me to the bathroom. So there are presence of guards that would also ensure his safe custody. And the key factor is, not once in either affidavit does he ever say, I was in fear for my life. I was afraid that these detainees would jump over the concertina wire and cut my throat, as appellant counsel said. So that's a key factor, too. He never states my life was in danger. He simply says, I was there.
Well, the safe custody that we're talking about in this instance is keeping the appellant in safe custody so he doesn't escape.
Yes, sir.
And we've established, if we're taking his allegation as true, that he was in double irons. He also alleges in his affidavit that the EPWs were free to walk around. They weren't required to have double irons. So how can the government at this point argue that it was a requirement for his, in order to keep him in custody and not allow him to escape, that it was required that he be in double irons and the EPWs not?
Well, I think what you have to look at is the requirement is that he prove that he was in leg irons for a purpose other than his normal confinement as part of his sentence. In other words, that culpable state of mind prong of the test for a violation of Article 55.
But you're saying that the government's doing it for his safe custody.
Well, no. What I'm saying, Your Honor, is that this court should not speculate about what the government knew or didn't know. It's up to the appellant to prove what the government knew and that they knew of this risk and disregarded it. And he hasn't done that. He simply says, I was in hand and leg irons. He doesn't say why he was in hand and leg irons.
But you're not responding to Judge Erzman's question.
You're talking about the deliberate indifference factor here. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about Article 55.
Yes, sir.
And I'm talking about the fact that we're accepting that he was in double irons. We're accepting the fact that, under the affidavit, that the EPWs were not in double irons, were free to walk around. And how, then, are we supposed to come to the conclusion that his being placed in double irons was required for safe custody? Of wise.
Oh, I understand what you're saying, Your Honor. Yeah. And again, I think that is the appellant's burden to show that he was not required. And it kind of answers your question in the negative. However, That's, when you look at the EPWs, he doesn't say...
And the government has no burden there at all. Is that the government's position to show that...
Yes, Your Honor. Lovett says that burden rests squarely on the appellant to show that this was done for a reason to punish him, that this was done with deliberate indifference to his health or safety, and he has not done that.
Well, he has established that the EPWs were not double-ironed. And so, I mean, that makes you wonder why we have an American prisoner who was double-ironed.
Well, again, Your Honor, if he had put in his affidavit that the EPWs were in this concertina wire, I wasn't in concertina wire. I was locked up in a cell, and while I was locked up in a cell, I also had to be in hand and leg irons. That would show a violation, but he hasn't done that. He simply says, I was here, I was in hand and leg irons. This court should presume that means I was punished.
Let's say the appellant's arguing that shows indifference. You have 150 Iraqis running around inside concertina wire, and you have him in his double shackles, and he's saying that's indifference. Now what's the government's response?
Well, the government's response...
I understand you're saying he hasn't met his burden. But let's say he has met his burden. What's the government's response?
Say that he has met his burden?
Or why doesn't that reflect indifference?
Well, he would have to show that the prison officials knew that this was an excessive risk and disregarded it, and he has not done that.
Well, the prison officials apparently know that it's not unsafe for custody reasons to keep the Iraqis within the wire like that.
Well, what the appellant doesn't show is what the government knows about these EPWs and what they know about his confinement conditions. What he doesn't show is what he was confined in and what the EPWs were confined in. He doesn't say the EPWs were free to roam around because they had guards all around this ring of concertina wire, whereas I had no guards around my ring of concertina wire.
So you're arguing, for all we know, he's only taken a snapshot of one portion of the compound.
Absolutely.
They may have trenches and stakes and all sorts of other stuff.
Absolutely.
Is your position.
It is the appellant's burden to show that even though they had that, they still kept him in leg irons, and therefore it's a violation of Article 55. And he has not met that burden.
Was he in immediate association with the EPWs?
No, he was not, Your Honor.
And what constitutes immediate association?
Immediate association, and I don't have any case law to back this up, but immediate association is more analogous to a situation where the appellant is in a cell next door to EPWs in the same building, or if he were in a tent within the same ring of concertina wire. Both of the appellant's affidavits, in his first affidavit on page 1, he says, we were separated by concertina wire. So that separation negates the immediate association.
So it's the concertina wire in and of itself. It doesn't matter about what the distance was between them. I mean, if they're a foot apart and there's a strand of concertina wire, in the government's view, that's not immediate association.
Well, it would show that they were separate. The problem is he doesn't give us distances. He doesn't say our camp was...
Well, he says concertina wire in conversation.
You can have a conversation across a considerable difference. And again, the appellant hasn't shown that what the distance was. But he does say that there was their strand of concertina wire, and he even says in his second affidavit, within our strand of concertina wire.
Well, they're talking to him. Doesn't that indicate that there is some immediate association?
Well, the allegation that they're talking to him, first of all, is in the second affidavit, which, going back to my first argument, this is part of the more egregious thing. So there's the improbability factor of that as well. But also, the appellant says that they were in their certain area, we were in our certain area. That's not immediate association.
I was in close proximity to the EPWs. In fact, the only thing that separated us from them was a single strand of concertina wire. EPWs would walk up to the wire and try to engage us in conversation, including one EPW who recognized me as his former guard. Now, I understand your argument that this may or may not be true, he may not meet his burden with this, but you need to respond to that fact and not some other affidavit.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
That sounds like a single strand of concertina wire.
But there was a single strand, but there was still separating them. And that
okay, but argue why that isn't an immediate association rather than some other camp.
Absolutely, Your Honor. That wasn't an immediate association because it was clearly delineated where the BWs went and where the appellant and his other two soldiers went. This wasn't a case where the appellant was thrown in the same ring of concertina wire. He was the only American there. This was a situation where, if this court is to believe the appellant's affidavit, that he was in a separate ring of concertina wire with two other Americans, clearly delineated area for American soldiers, separate from the area where the EPWs were kept. And that shows that he was not in immediate association with the EPWs.
Counsel, I'd like to go back to the Farmer test now and the question of whether that test is applicable to all aspects of Article 55. The test of showing both the objective conditions and the deliberate indifference have to do with prison conditions. Does that test apply if there's a violation of Article 55 on its face by flogging or branding? In other words, if someone were flogged or branded, would there be a requirement to show deliberate indifference, or is that on its face a violation of Article 55?
Well, I think with the flogging and the branding, I think that would certainly meet the objective prong of it. Now, it could be a situation where the branding was by accident, or this was something where a beam fell and had the effect of flogging a confinee, and the appellant would still have to show the culpable state of mind.
How do you get flogged or branded by accident?
Well, that's again, what the appellant would have to show in that situation is that there was also this culpable state of mind that I was flogged beyond what I was adjudged as my sentence, and that this was done with the deliberate indifference to my health or safety.
As I read Article 55, there's no sentence that can include flogging or branding.
I think those are a violation of Article 55 in that circumstance. Certainly, I think, would be a violation of the Eighth Amendment as well, but that's
and
not...
And so why does deliberate indifference have to be shown as to shackling or double irons? Shackling or double irons is expressly prohibited, except when required by safe custody. So in that situation, it's not clear to me that the Farmer against Brennan test applies. If you have shackling or double irons, why isn't that a straightforward case of if shackling or double irons is shown, then the burden shifts to the government to show the exception applies?
Because, Your Honor, I think that exception is there, that safe custody exception is there, and that's what makes it different from the flogging and the branding. And according to Lovett, this court has shown that the appellant has to show that culpable state of mind. So because you have that extra...
In Lovett, was there shackling and double irons?
No, Your Honor, there was not.
That was a prison condition case.
Yes, it was, and that's what we have here is the appellant is saying these conditions of my confinement are what led to these violations.
Well, there are several different things going on. One, the meals, the clothing, the exposure to other prisoners. Those are the conditions of confinement. But why isn't the shackling not a condition of confinement in that sense? It is a express prohibition like branding or tattooing or flogging under Article 55.
Yes, Your Honor, but there's also that exception for safe custody.
Right, and then so my question there is, why does indifference or deliberate indifference come into play at all here? If there's shackling or double irons, it either is or it isn't permissible, and the only thing that makes it permissible is safe custody, not indifference or lack of indifference.
Yes, Your Honor, but the appellant still has to prove that deliberate indifference. The appellant has the burden.
Why? Let's have a case in which you had a full factual development in a debate hearing at trial. If the defense demonstrates that someone has been double shackled, why at trial would there be any burden on him to show deliberate indifference? Why, if you look at the plain words of the statute, does the burden not then shift to the government to demonstrate that this was done for safe custody?
The burden doesn't shift, Your Honor, because in Lovett, this court said that it's not going to speculate about what the government knew. It said that it's the appellant's burden to show that. I think Lovett pretty clearly states...
I understand Lovett, but Lovett didn't deal with that aspect of Article 55, which had an express prohibition on a specific act. Lovett was dealing with the generality of prison conditions. So my question is, what does Lovett have to do at all with shackling?
Well, it does, Your Honor, because in United States versus White, this court held that the Farmer versus Brennan test is applicable to violations of Article 55. Being shackled and hand leg irons is prohibited by Article 55, so therefore that test applies, that objective and subjective test both apply.
Again, in White, were we dealing with any of the express prohibitions in Article 55, or were we dealing with prison conditions?
No, Your Honor, it was prison conditions. It was harassment and things like that.
So that's my question here, is why should we apply Farmer against Brennan to the express prohibitions of Article 55? If those are shown...
Well, because, Your Honor, there is that exception for safe custody. So therefore, it shows that just a per se showing of leg irons is not going to be a violation of Article 55 because there is that exception. So that burden should be on the appellant to show that this was done for reasons other than safe custody.
So at trial, the defense would have to put on somebody to show that it was not done for safe custody as well? That's the government's position?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Looking back at the improbability factor, the appellant has failed to complain about or even mention these conditions in his post-trial submissions. And the fact that he is raising them now that he has reached his second-to-last chance on appeal casts serious doubt on the truthfulness of those facts. If things were really as horrible as he alleged, he would immediately put them in his post-trial submissions and not waited 3 years to bring them forward. The appellant was also convicted of making a false official statement. And so this brings his credibility into question.
What if he didn't understand the legal significance of these factors? I mean, isn't that a possibility that until he sat down and discussed it with someone, he didn't realize that this may give rise to a claim?
Well, Your Honor, he did have a chance to sit down and discuss it with somebody. His request for clemency is written on trial defense letterhead a week and a half after he used to quit. Shows that he had contact with his attorney.
But at that time, he may not have thought that the conditions that he was subjected to had any real significance.
Well, Your Honor, I think that goes to the exhaustion of administrative remedies, that he had an opportunity to bring this up to his defense attorney, but his post-trial submissions are silent. And this represented the appellant's best chance to get relief for these alleged violations.
But do you think complaining about these things in your clemency petitions is the most effective way to get clemency?
It may have been the most effective way because the Gaffney Authority took action on 7 March of 2004, and that was when the appellant still had about 4 to 5 months left on his sentence.
And what about Judge Erdman's question? Maybe he didn't comprehend the relevance of what he had experienced.
Well, I think his affidavit, if you read his affidavit, it sounds like these were, and I believe in the appellant's brief, he mentions abhorrent conditions. If these conditions were so abhorrent, it goes against the truthfulness of the allegations to say, well, they were abhorrent, but I didn't think to bring them up to my trial defense attorney when my trial defense attorney asked me, what do you have to get so that we can request clemency? And the community authority, that was a perfect opportunity because he could have gotten a reduction of his confinement. He could have got to go home early, but he failed to bring it up. Also,
your argument is that his failure to include them at clemency and in his other earlier submissions compellingly demonstrate, which is the test, compellingly demonstrate that everything he has said in his affidavits are false.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Now, despite having contact with his attorney, the appellant also did not file an Article 138 complaint. So even if this court finds that the request for clemency was not the best method, he still had the option of an Article 138 complaint, and he failed to exhaust that despite having contact with his attorney. Now, the exhaustion requirement exists to encourage the resolution of these issues at the lowest possible level, and the appellant should have brought them up at the lowest possible level and addressed them. However, he has waited until a second-to-last chance on appeal to bring all these allegations up. The exhaustion requirement also exists to ensure that the appellate develops an adequate record upon which the Army Court and this honorable court could rely to decide if the appellant deserves relief. And the appellant has failed to do that. He says he was with these other two soldiers, but that he didn't obtain statements from them. He never says that he tried to obtain statements from them. And now that 3 years have passed, it's going to be much less probable to track them down now. Also, the appellant's treatment does not qualify as unusual or egregious circumstances. He had contact with his attorney shortly after he left DeCritt, but his confinement conditions were much less severe than those in United States versus Coffey. And this court's holding in Coffey implied that those conditions were not unusual and egregious. And that was, the appellant in Coffey was locked in a cell for 40 days, went 8 days without a shower, 2 weeks without clean bed linens, couldn't wash his clothes, didn't have water for 5 days, couldn't wash or flush his toilet, and was denied access to trial defense. None of those conditions are ones that the appellant does not allege conditions nearly as severe as that. Looking back to the objective standard, in United States versus Sanchez, this court held that any alleged psychological pain must be a well-established and clinically diagnosed anxiety or depression. Now, the gist of the appellant's claims, he sums up his complaints that he was humiliated, that he was degraded, and that his conditions were miserable. However, he does not present any evidence of any clinically diagnosed psychological trauma, and that's another reason why he fails on that objective prong. If there are no further questions, I'm going to give a brief conclusion. Under the fourth Ginn principle, the appellate filings in the record not only compellingly demonstrate the improbability of the facts that appellant alleges, but they cast serious doubt upon their truthfulness. The appellant has failed to show that he was denied life's necessities, failed to show that he suffered from any clinically diagnosed psychological trauma. He failed to show that the prison officials had a culpable state of mind that amounted to a deliberate indifference to his health or safety, and he failed to exhaust the numerous administrative remedies that were available to him. The government asks that this honorable court affirm the Army Court's ruling. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
Yes, sir.
May it please the court, subject, of course, to the court's questions, I'd like to focus on the three statutes involved here, three articles of UCMJ, and the appropriate analysis that the court should give in each of those three relevant statutes. The first is, of course, the Article 12, the immediate association analysis. In considering that as a separate, standalone violation, the facts, of course, based upon this court's acceptance of the affidavits as provided, are pretty clear that we have an American soldier who's in immediate association, immediate, direct, close distance from, and ability to interact with enemy prisoners. So we have violation of Article 12. That does not fall under the Eighth Amendment framework analysis on its own. That is a strict statutory violation. It is an explicit prohibition of that specific article.
What's the remedy?
Appropriate relief to remedy, well, in asking for this case, Your Honor, we seek a disapproval of the bad conduct discharge for the totality of violations.
What's the standard for a remedy of an Article 12 violation?
I've not found a remedy ever given by this court for an Article 12 violation, Your Honor.
How many days did he suffer?
He suffered 7 days, Your Honor.
7 days.
7 days in immediate association.
Why don't we give him 7 days credit then?
Certainly that would be a remedy the court should fashion, Your Honor. Moving along to the violation of Article 55. Again, although Article 55 addresses cruel and unusual punishment and therefore applies the Eighth Amendment analysis, there is within the Article 55 explicit statutory requirements and prohibitions, and one of those being double irons for no purposes, excuse me, a prohibition on the use of double irons or single or double irons other than the purposes of safe custody. In examining that particular issue, the court should not apply the complete Eighth Amendment analysis, but should first examine whether or not the double irons were in fact used, which is accepting the affidavits, undisputed at this point, and it looked at whether or not, in the court's de novo review, whether or not it was done in safe custody. And this court reviews the execution of punishment under its Article 67 powers generally de novo to ensure that punishments are carried out appropriately.
Are you suggesting that we should not apply the exhaustion requirement to the single and double irons?
No, we should not, Your Honor. It's an explicit prohibition, and it is, well, and I'll get to that in a minute, but if you're considering it as an overall constitutional violation and Eighth Amendment analysis, then the exhaustion requirement would apply.
Why shouldn't we apply to Article 55 violations for purposes of assessing
sorry,
the
I
accuracy?
I just realized what your question was. I thought you were asking about the deliberate indifference.
No, the exhaustion requirement.
No, naturally, as it deals with confinement, it's something that falls under the same network. The exhaustion administrative remedies would be an appropriate analysis for the double IR standard. Absolutely, Your Honor. I apologize. Thirdly, however, bringing to my next point, applying the deliberate indifference standard is inappropriate in this case. The deliberate indifference standard is a constitutional analysis that you should consider in the totality of the circumstances, and that is the third violation, that is a constitutional Eighth Amendment violation and also linked to an Article 55 violation under the Cruel and Unusual Punishment Clause. In doing so, this court should properly apply the same test that did in U.S. v. White, and that is consider whether we have a sufficiently serious act. Appellant contends that each of those two violations, the double irons and the immediate association, per se constitutes a sufficiently serious act, with the understanding, of course, that when we say double irons, we're talking about not for the purposes of safe custody. The facts show that safe custody was not an element or a requirement, a factor. He was held in the same confined facility as 150 other individuals not in double irons. Therefore, there is no basis to say that why this particular individual, who was not placed in pretrial confinement, not convicted of any violent crime, who is not a member of that country or able to escape into the outside world, would need such restraint. And of course,
well, the government's response to that is, we only know, if we take everything as true, we only know about this single concertina wire. We don't know what's on the other side of the three perimeters. So we don't know, for example, whether this appellant could walk out to the east and there are 40 guard towers to the west.
I'm sorry, but I'm going to respectfully disagree with the government and their reading of that. And I think the only logical reference based on the reading of both affidavits together is that there is a confinement facility that has got a perimeter. And inside that confinement facility, there are 100 to 150 Iraqis and the appellant and the other two Americans similarly confined. And inside that facility, there's a string of concertina wire around them. And so all means to maintain control of the Iraqis also equally apply to the Americans. Nowhere does the appellant allege that he was in a separate facility adjacent to or connected to by a strand of concertina wire. He claims he was in the facility and he was only delineated by a strand of concertina wire, identifying virtually him as an American to all these folks who are threats to American safety. If I may, I'd like to conclude by saying that every once in a while there's a case which comes along and is uniquely military in its law, and that this is such a case. This court bears the heavy burden of steering justice and a path for law for service members at home and abroad. Certainly, it would be favorable had better documentation and records be kept to make a more expeditious and easy resolution of Private Wise's case. Nonetheless, it is the duty of this court to ensure that American service members are treated like American service members throughout the time of their punishment and not thrown in with enemies in the United States. And for that reason, we ask for appropriate relief.
We thank counsel for both parties for your argument today. The case is now submitted, and we will take a brief recess and reconvene at 10 minutes after 10. Our second case this morning is United States against Carruthers. Counsel for defense.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Captain Kathleen Escarpato, and together with Lieutenant Colonel Stephen Henricks, we represent the appellant in this case, Staff Sergeant Kim Carruthers. military judge failed to address the extreme bias and motives of the government's key witness in this case, effectively robbing the appellant twice of his ability to put forth an effective defense. First, he failed to allow the defense...
Could you move that microphone over a little closer, please? Thank you.
First, he failed to allow the defense to fully cross-examine Sergeant First Class Rafferty as to the details of his plea agreement with the convening authority and with the U.S. Attorney's Office. And then he failed to give a defense-requested and mandatory leniency instruction. This court should set aside the findings and sentence. Now, the first issue granted is the Sixth Amendment Confrontation Clause violation. When error is found, the government must show that the error was harmless by a reasonable doubt, beyond a reasonable doubt. Three points I'd like you to take away today, Your Honors, is first that the military judge ignored the case law that says that bias is always relevant, especially when a government witness is an accomplice. Second, that he then made factual findings contrary to that case law. And third, that those findings prejudiced the appellant because the panel was misled did not have the complete picture. The military judge was wrong on two counts in his ruling. First, he concluded that the evidence of bias was not relevant. And then he said that even if it is relevant, that the probative value was substantially outweighed by the danger of misleading the members. However, the evidence sought on cross-examination as to the bias and motive of this witness was highly relevant. It showed why he had a continuing incentive to fabricate a story. He was looking for his freedom. He was looking for the potential that was outlined in his plea agreement that he could potentially get a suspended sentence, probation. That's a strong motivation.
Did his plea agreement guarantee him probation?
No, it did not, Your Honor.
What did his plea agreement expose him to?
His plea agreement was that first, and much of this was brought out on direct by the trial counsel, but it outlined that he would not be tried by a military court-martial, therefore he would not be subject to punitive discharge, and he would be able to potentially keep his retirement. He had 22 years in at this point. It also specified that he would be tried of one felony count of larceny in the federal courts prosecuted by the U.S. Attorney's Office.
And what was his maximum exposure?
His maximum exposure, Your Honor, was 10 years confinement.
So it's your argument that you wanted the members to be told that he still faced 10 years confinement?
Your Honor, I think the appellant wanted it to... the panel to understand that he could get, even with a conviction, the potential of probation.
Up to 10 years confinement?
Yes, Your Honor.
So in your position, they should have been allowed to advise the members that he could face anything from probation to 10 years confinement?
In order to allow the members to have the complete picture, that would have been appropriate, Your Honor. However...
And then would you be... doesn't that raise the risk, then, that... here's a guy who's cooperating in theory, and he's facing up to 10 years. Doesn't that somehow implicate the potential that could encourage members to lean towards 10 years or more?
That might be a danger that the defense was willing to take, but the actual purpose behind the cross-examination that the defense attorney wanted to get into was to expose the bias that this witness had, that being that he could get probation if he performed well. He had the special assistant U.S. attorney sitting at the trial counsel's table acting as she was the assistant trial counsel. So he's facing down his future prosecutor, and he knows that he has to put on the best show that he can to get the best recommendation that he can when his case goes to the U.S. Attorney's.
Counsel, the Rafferty pretrial agreement isn't in the record. Do we know, or how do we know, that agreement would reflect that he could get probation?
Well, Your Honor, there are multiple references to the signed plea agreement that was signed, and during the 39A session, both parties agreed that there was a pretrial agreement, that it had been signed, and that the potential sentences were the maximum punishment of 10 years to no confinement whatsoever. So that's on the record that was everybody's understanding of the agreement.
So the most that could come if the testimony would have been allowed was exactly what Judge Baker said, that the members would be informed that he could get anything from probation to 10 years.
Yes, the members would be informed of the entire spectrum of his potential punishment.
How does that then add to the information that they already had?
The information they already had was that he would be tried for one felony count of larceny of public property, and that he would not be tried in a court-martial and therefore might not or would not face a punitive discharge. That was drawn out by the trial counsel on direct examination, and of course in the light most favorable to the prosecution case is to have that information that may be used against them drawn out on direct. The problem here is that when the defense attorney wanted to delve into the details of that plea agreement, he was stopped. The case law, which goes back to Supreme Court cases, Davis v. Alaska in 74 and Delaware v. Van Arsdell in 86, said that it's well established that evidence of bias is always relevant. They also said that it should be admissible as discrediting the witness and affecting the weight of his testimony. Now, several federal courts have gone on to explain specific instances where bias evidence must be fully developed. They talk about evidence of bias can suggest why a witness is lying. That's why this was so important for the defense counsel to get this information out.
Well, let's look what was in the record. I mean, during the cross-examination, they got out the fact he said that his plea agreement would get him out of the court-martial and a punitive discharge, that the government would take care of him if he did a good job. It meant that his story would have to be consistent with what he had told the investigators, and that he'd only be charged with one kind of larceny, despite having stolen property on lots of occasions. Now, it seems to me that that would indicate that he knows if he doesn't toe the line, testify as to what the government wants to testify him to, he could be subject to a greater penalty.
He knows that, Your Honor, but the panel didn't have the full picture, and that's the problem here.
Why don't they have the full picture from that?
They didn't know what the ultimate bias that he had, the potential for no confinement, for freedom, that was not going to be an option if he went to a court-martial. If he were facing a contested case in court-martial such as Staff Sergeant Carruthers, then he would have been facing up to 11 specifications of larceny and a charge of conspiracy as well.
So it comes down to that one element, that if they would have known about the potential for probation, they would have been fully informed.
They would, yes, Your Honor. They would have been at least more able to fully weigh his credibility and to acknowledge that he could not deviate from the story that he'd already been giving the investigators in the U.S. Attorney's Office over the course of a two-year investigation and the course of an investigation which charges had already been preferred against him before he made this deal and then dismissed so that he could be the key witness for the prosecution against the appellant in this case. Now, this court recently...
Was there evidence that the defense wanted to bring out that the concept of probation was specifically tied to his testimony?
Yes, Your Honor. The question that the Civilian Defense Council asked and to which it was objected to was specifically, you understand, Sergeant Raftery, that you could possibly just get suspended, and then that he was cut off, and that's where the objection arose. So yes, that was the key information, although there could have been a line of questions subsequent to that that the defense wanted to get out.
Based on what we can take judicial notice of in terms of the federal sentencing guidelines, because we're talking here about the witness who is going to go into the federal civilian system, and the accused, now appellant, who was in the court-martial system. And in the court-martial system, the accused was exposed to 11 specifications and the possibility of punishment of a maximum of what?
I believe it was 120 years.
120 years down to zero. And the court martial would have complete discretion as to whether to give him zero or 120 years.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Now, in the federal civilian system, what was the exposure of the witness Rafferty?
Based on his plea to a single count of larceny, Your Honor, he was exposed to no confinement, no punishment, up to 10 years confinement.
And did the trial judge, or would the trial judge in the Rafferty case, have complete discretion of doing 0 to 10 years, or would the possibility of probation, that is zero, be dependent upon the witness's cooperation at the accused trial?
Your Honor, the special assistant U.S. attorney, who was the assistant trial counsel in the Carruthers case, would be able to make a recommendation to the trial court as to his assistance as the key witness in this case. So, yes, the trial court would still have its own discretion to punish him up to the 10 years, but the likelihood of that happening...
My question goes the other way. Under the federal sentencing guidelines, could the trial judge give a sentence of no punishment or probation without evidence of cooperation by the accused? That is, basic question is, did the trial judge in federal system, under the federal sentencing guidelines, have the same discretion that a court martial would have as far as giving a sentence that involved no confinement?
Yes, the guidelines included, without any recommendation, the guidelines went from the supervised probation to 10 years confinement. Now, I would want to point out a few more of the federal court cases which specifically talk about the ability of a defense to inquire into more than just the existence of a plea agreement. And that's really what we had here. The defense counsel was not able to question beyond the existence of the plea agreement, which had already been drawn out on direct by the trial counsel. But that's not sufficient. The court went on to say that it must be able to expose the full benefits that the witness hopes to gain. And that's the line of questioning that the civilian defense counsel wanted to get out in this particular case. He wanted to know Rafferty's understanding of what he could get if he cooperated and towed the government line in this case. Court went on to say that the details are therefore highly relevant, especially where a witness has not yet been sentenced. He has a continuing incentive to strengthen the government case.
So what evidence would the defense have brought out about the difference between 0 and 10 in terms of the cooperation that the witness provided at trial? That is, what was the relationship between the witness's testimony at trial and the likelihood that the witness at his own federal civilian criminal trial would have gotten a sentence closer to zero?
The difference, Your Honor, is his understanding that he could do absolutely no confinement, that he could get that probation if he performed well enough for the government. That was his continuing incentive.
Where is the evidence of record that there was a link between his performance at this trial and getting close to zero at his own trial?
Well, Your Honor, I think that would have been the line of questions that the defense counsel asked, as well as in the 39A session, when this was being discussed, the defense counsel clearly articulated that he wanted to show the continuing incentive, and that, I think, is the key in this case that shows the bias that this witness had. If he had already been sentenced...
I understand that. What I'm trying to get at is, what is the link between his testimony, the witness's testimony at the trial that we had here, and where his sentence would have fallen in the 0 to 10 range at his own trial?
I think I understand your question, but it really goes to that witness's understanding of his plea agreement. That is the link. It's what did he understand in the case?
Why isn't it just as likely under his plea agreement that he would have gotten 10 years as opposed to 0 years? what was there about the plea agreement and his testimony that made it more likely that he would get zero rather than 10?
Well, he wasn't allowed to testify to that, Your Honor, so we don't
know. Whose responsibility is it to put the plea agreement into the record or get on the evidence of the Article 39A session? What was at stake here?
Well, Your Honor, and that is, it's a great point. And in fact, the judge, when he made his ruling, not only said, I'm not going to allow further questions into the details of this plea agreement, but I'm not going to allow that document to be admitted either. So we have a case here
Did the judge preclude the defense from admitting the document as an appellate record? Not for presentation in the court martial, but what precluded the defense from putting into the record of trial for purposes of our review on appeal, what was precisely at stake here?
Your Honor, it would have been much more helpful for this court to have that document before you. We don't. However, it's fairly well laid out in the record of trial what the plea agreement exactly was.
Why can't we then presume that if he sang beautifully at trial, did everything the government wanted to say, he was just as much risk of getting 10 years as 0 years?
Your Honor, because it goes to his understanding, not what actually might have happened 6 months down the road or whenever his trial was to take place, but what his understanding was, and that's what the defense counsel really wanted to get at.
And the defense counsel couldn't have asked for an Article 39A session to put on the record that what's at stake here is his understanding that he's more likely to get zero? I mean, how do we know that he had an understanding that he was more likely to get zero?
It would have been better, Your Honor, if the defense, there was a 39A session, and the defense counsel did say that. However, it would have been better for this court to analyze if they had called the witness back during the 39A session to find out what his understanding was. The judge did not do that. The defense counsel did not request it.
You're asking us to assume that based on the defense counsel's proffer, that is, that he wanted to establish that there was a greater likelihood of zero, we should decide the case on that basis.
Well, Your Honor, I think from the line of questions that the defense counsel had been asking leading up to that, he had asked him at several points, the witness, your understanding of this plea agreement is that you will not face a punitive discharge. Your understanding is, and then he got to this one question that had not already been brought out on direct, and that's where his line of questioning was objected to, and the judge...
Where in the record can we look to say that the defense wanted to show that his understanding was that he had a greater chance of getting a zero confinement based on his testimony?
Your Honor, I will check the record for... I do not believe the defense counsel actually says we want to show that he'll get zero confinement. However, from
or that
the
he understood
argument... It will show in the 39A session that he articulated, we want to show the bias and that the probative value of this bias and motive is crucial. It's not offered for any improper purpose. It's offered merely to show the bias that this witness has, that he might get probation. And again, I think that this court can infer from the record, as we know, that the continuing incentive also included the fact that the Sousa was sitting right there at the trial counsel's desk and was the primary trial counsel who argued during the 39A motion.
Would you agree that there was evidence of Rafferty's bias that was admitted, but it just wasn't to the same detail that you would like to have seen it?
Yes, Your Honor. Again, I would stress, though, that came out on direct, and that it's only when the defense wanted to go into the details of his understanding of what he might actually get, the probation, that's where he was stopped. Now, this court recently in U.S. v. Moss, again, citing that the exclusion of evidence of bias raises confrontation clause issues, cited back to some of these Supreme federal court cases, saying that the witness partiality of a witness is always relevant, is discrediting the witness and affecting the weight of his testimony. This court also went further to say that the rules of evidence allow liberal admission of this biased type evidence. Now here, the military judge abused that discretion by failing to allow the cross-examination into the details. He was only allowed to ask to query into the existence of the agreement. Now, this court in Moss also applied a harmless error analysis, of which there were five factors. First, it said that the importance of the witness's testimony, what was the importance of the witness's testimony to the prosecution case? Now here, Rafferty was the key witness. He was the prosecution's case. That's why it took them 2 years of investigation, and only when they had some kind of agreement set in place were they able to actually take Carruthers' case to trial. Now, the second issue is whether the evidence was cumulative. There is no other evidence. Unfortunately, we don't have an admission of the pretrial agreement or the plea bargain in the record for the panel to review. So they had no other means by which to assess the true bias and depth of the bias of this particular witness. Next question is whether there's any corroboration or contradictory evidence on material points. Again, on material points goes to the bias that the defense was trying to get out. And no, we don't have anything other than what was brought out on direct. Now, the fourth factor is the extent of the cross that was permitted. And again, the trial judge limited the questions to the existence of the plea agreement, which is not sufficient. And finally, the court asked what was the strength of the prosecution's case, which goes back to the factor one. This witness was the key government witness. Now, if there are no further questions, I'd move on to the next issue. The second granted issue is the instruction of leniency. Now, 2 points I'd like you to consider, Your Honors, are first that the leniency here goes back to the first issue, the bias and the motive that this witness had to lie on the stand. The bias instruction is what I would prefer to call it. It goes to the heart of Sergeant Rafferty's of the defense case, that Sergeant Rafferty had a bias in favor of government prosecution. Now, there are two subsections to this issue. First, there's the mandatory instruction of Note 5. Now, this should be reviewed de novo, as it is a question of whether the jury was properly instructed. The second issue is Note 4. That's the true bias instruction here. The failure to give that requested instruction should be reviewed for an abuse of discretion. Now, at this point, the military judge failed to give any kind of analysis to his ruling. He simply decided that he was not going to give this defense proffered instruction. Now, so and therefore, this court is left with little choice but to give no deference to the judge's ruling. However, if we go into the next steps that are outlined in Gibson and other cases this court has decided, there are three factors that the court needs to analyze to determine whether any error was harmless. And the first question is whether the defense requested instruction was correct. Now, in this case, the defense wanted to lay out for the panel how they were supposed to weigh evidence of bias, how they were supposed to weigh particular witnesses' testimonies when they had plea agreements. So yes, the gist of this instruction was correct. Second, was it substantially covered in another instruction? We would argue it was not. The accomplice instruction that was given was an incomplete picture. First, it laid out all of the potential accomplices in this case, to include some of the defense witnesses who were not testifying under any kind of grants of immunity or leniency or plea agreements.
Well, the instruction that the judge gave said that an accomplice may be motivated to falsify testimony in whole or in part because of his own self-interest in receiving immunity from prosecution or leniency in a forthcoming prosecution. Now, does that not cover or at least reference leniency?
It does reference leniency, but again, Your Honor, it's giving the ambiguous statement, throwing it out there to the members. These witnesses might be accomplices. That's for you to decide. If you decide they are accomplices, this is how you should weigh it. And he lumped them all in together. Now, I see that I'm getting close to running out of time, but I'll finish this answer. The defense requested instruction wanted to go farther than that. It wanted to be able to set aside those two witnesses, specifically Sergeant Rafferty, as actually testifying under grants of immunity, and specifically how that panel should have weighed that witness's credibility. Now, the third and final question is whether the instruction was on such a vital point that failure to give it seriously impaired the effective presentation of the defense. Now, the appellant argues that this was the key point of their entire case, is that that witness had a bias. That's what they were trying to get out and failed to get out on the first issue because they were denied proper cross-examination. And therefore, it seriously impaired their defense, their right to have the panel properly instructed and to have the full picture before them, the weight that they can give various witnesses, depending on their reasons for testifying.
Counsel, you have an opportunity to sum up during your rebuttal.
Yes.
Thank you. Counsel for the government.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Captain Todd Cushenthal, and along with Colonel John Miller, I represent the United States government in this case. Appellant's conviction and sentence should be upheld because the potential punishment that Sergeant Rafferty was facing was too speculative to justify inquiry into the sentence parameters of his pretrial agreement, and appellant's counsel inquired extensively into the issue of bias regarding Sergeant Rafferty. Further, Appellant received the essence of the instruction he requested from the military judge. Turning to the first granted issue, the cross-examination of Sergeant Rafferty, Appellant has waived this issue. After raising an objection during the 39A session, the judge, during his discussion with counsel, informed the civil defense attorney that if he was able to come back with any case law which would justify the cross-examination of Sergeant Rafferty into the sentence parameters of his pretrial agreement, the judge would allow Sergeant Rafferty to be recalled and answer those questions. Appellant failed to produce any case law or bring the issue up again for the military judge.
Under what theory does the failure to pass a legal a law school test constitute waiver? Or as the judge said, if you got some case law, I'll give it to you. What if the judge was completely wrong? Is the counsel responsible at the time for making a legal argument as to why evidence should be admitted? Isn't it the responsibility of the military judge to know the law?
Certainly, Your Honor. I think what it shows, though, is that there was no case law which would support the inquiry Sergeant Rafferty.
That's a different issue. Mm-hmm. That goes to whether the military judge's ruling was correct. Mm-hmm. Doesn't have anything to do with waiver. If the defense counsel made an objection, isn't it up to the military judge to determine whether it's correct or not? If the military judge is right in his ruling, then the defense loses on appeal. If the military judge is wrong, the defense wins on appeal. I don't understand how waiver gets into this.
Well, certainly, Your Honor. It's up to the military judge to apply the law correctly. You're correct in that, Your Honor. Apart from waiver, though, the real heart of the matter, the two justifications for why the inquiry was not permissible. First, there's purely speculation as to Sergeant Rafferty's possible sentence. At the time the appellant was tried at his court-martial, Sergeant Rafferty had not had charges filed against him yet by the federal government. In essence, then, his pretrial agreement was still a work in progress. As far as his potential punishment, all anybody knew at the time was the minimum for the charge which was being contemplated being brought against him was probation, and the maximum was 10 years confinement. Nobody knew Sergeant Rafferty appellant, anybody at the time, what the punishment Sergeant Rafferty would receive would be. It's a long, drawn-out process, the federal sentencing guidelines process, take that from beginning to trial. They had a long route ahead of them, and it was purely speculation at the time to guess at all what Sergeant Rafferty could have received. Again, it could have been from the minimum to the maximum to anywhere in between. And as such, the military judge was correct in not allowing a cross-examination, as it certainly would have done nothing but confuse the panel. The second major issue for keeping out the cross-examination was that the issue of bias had already been explored fully, or had been explored fully, or extensively, I should say. I'm sorry. Had been explored extensively by Sergeant Rafferty's or appellant's counsel. If you look at the record of trial, approximately 4 pages of the first 20 pages of the cross-examination is spent eliciting factors from Sergeant Rafferty to support the issue of bias. What is elicited from appellant's counsel is that Sergeant Rafferty is not facing a court-martial. By not facing a court-martial, he does not run the risk of a punitive discharge. And in doing so, Sergeant Rafferty, a soldier who is approaching retirement age, does not have that worry on the table. That is brought out during cross-examination. It's brought out that Sergeant Rafferty is doing what he can do to avoid a court-martial because he knows the issue about the punitive discharge. It's brought out that Sergeant Rafferty is working with the government trying to come up with a pretrial agreement. It's brought out in cross-examination that leniency can depend on Sergeant Rafferty's performance at appellant's court-martial.
Why isn't it important then for the panel to understand what leniency is at stake? For example, if the sentencing guidelines, as they do in some areas, provided for in a federal civilian trial virtually very little discretion to the judge, and the judge had only a decision between, let's say, 10 and 9 years. Isn't that vastly different from a case in which the judge's discretion would be between probation and 10 years?
I'm sorry, sir, can you repeat the question?
Yeah. Under the federal sentencing guidelines, depending on the nature of the offense, mm-hmm. the judge's discretion varies considerably. In some cases under the federal sentencing guidelines, the judge has very little discretion to depart, to in which to have a range of sentencing. In other cases, depending on the offense, the range is pretty great. Why wouldn't it be important to know, for the panel to know, that what was at stake here was everything from 0 to 10 years, as opposed to between 9 and 10. Why should the members be sitting there speculating among themselves? Well, yeah, the witness's cooperation is important here, but maybe it doesn't mean very much because there's only a year or two confinement at stake. Why shouldn't they know that what's at stake here is the range between 10 all the way down to 0?
What is important, Your Honor, is that, again, it's purely speculation. There was no understanding what Sergeant Rafferty was facing. And to answer your question, in the...
But why would that be speculation? The federal sentencing guidelines are published. Mm-hmm. The nature of the charge that he would have faced on one felony is well known. Mm-hmm. And so this wouldn't be a matter of speculation. It would be a matter that could be quite definitely ascertained. That is, his risk at trial, Rafferty, the witness's risk at trial, was 0 to 10. What the members were speculating about, possibly, would be, well, what was at stake? They could do nothing other than speculate here on this record because they had no information whatsoever.
We haven't told the panel anything, Your Honor, that they wouldn't have already been able to contemplate that the punishment Sergeant Rafferty was facing could have been on the low end or could have been on the high end, sort of added nothing to the...
How did they know what the low end and the high end was? How did they know it was 0 to 10 as opposed to 10 to 15 or 20 to 30? or 30 to 32? How did the members know what was at stake here?
The panel did not know, would not have known what the punishment for the exact charge would carry. What is important for this case, Your Honor, is that if the evidence had come in as to the range Sergeant Rafferty was facing, it would have opened up, in effect, a whole can of worms for the court-martial. The defense would have elicited testimony about the light end. The government had to come back and respond with what the high end would have been. And that would have ended up potentially turning Appellant's court-martial into an issue about Sergeant Rafferty, when it's not about Sergeant Rafferty. The court-martial was facing the issue of what Appellant's conduct was. So it would have been... the judge made the correct decision in not allowing the cross-examination on this issue.
The judge seemed to find it was okay to ask about the bad the punitive discharge or the absence of a punitive discharge. That was at stake for Rafferty.
That is a difference between the two court-martials, sir, and that may have been why the judge was made the decision to allow that to illustrate that. Sergeant Rafferty, by going to federal court, was in a different type of proceeding than he would be if he was court-martialed. So it's a different rationale, which I'm sure the court applied in making that decision as opposed to the issue about the sentence.
There are no sentencing guidelines in courts-martial. What do the sentencing guidelines say about witness cooperation and what a judge is supposed to do with that?
It's something, sir, that my understanding is the judge can take cooperation, among other things, into consideration, but then it's the judge's decision in the federal system as to what is appropriate, that he is allowed to differ if he feels it's appropriate from what the government is recommending.
And there's no such, there's no parallel to that in the military justice system, is there?
No, Your Honor.
Why wouldn't it be important for the members to know that? To know that when Rafferty went into the civilian system, he was going to be involved in an entirely different range of sentencing than the sentencing that the members were familiar with in the military justice system.
And that may have been an area, sir, that the judge may have allowed if it had come up, but that line of questioning was not raised. What was raised was the point which was trying to be made that Sergeant Rafferty was going to receive probation, which was speculative. No one knew. It could have been probation, could have been higher than that, could have been anywhere on continuum as far as possible punishments go. Even if the court were to construe that the military judge erred in not allowing the cross-examination, the error was harmless. There was abundant evidence of Sergeant Rafferty's, of appellant's guilt, apart from Sergeant Rafferty's testimony. Just a kind of a short recitation of some of the other evidence against appellant. Government items were seized from storage facilities which he utilized. DRMO documents were seized from his quarters. A handwriting analysis testified as to the linkage between Sergeant Rafferty's signature and some of the signatures being used on DRMO forms, which were forged. Some soldier signatures appeared on forms who were no longer stationed at Fort Bragg. Other witnesses testified that the appellant gave military property away. And there was testimony that appellant called some of these people afterwards when the investigation was ongoing and told them to get rid of the property. And there were other co-conspirators that also testified, in addition to Sergeant Rafferty. So there was an abundance of evidence, apart from Sergeant Rafferty's testimony, as to appellant's guilt. So thus it can be said that there was no error in the judge's decision if the court were to conclude that it was error to keep out the cross-examination. Plus, of course, the issue of bias was explored in great detail. Again, it took up about 4 pages of the first 20 pages of the cross-examination. Subject to any more questions on the first granted issue, I'll now turn to the second granted issue. Paul received what he wanted from the military judge. The military judge, first of all, he gave the instruction that he intended to give. The military judge did not misstate the instructions. If you look at the history developed in the transcript, the compass instruction was part of the original instructions the judge was contemplating giving. When it came back a day later that appellant requested a proposed instruction, the military judge rejected that and said, I'm just going to give the standard instructions, which is what he did. The compass instruction was appropriate. First of all, Sergeant Rafferty was an accomplice to appellant. The other individuals named by military judge in his instruction were also accomplices. If you look at what they did, these witnesses, they were criminally involved in the offense with which the accused was charged, which is the definition of what an accomplice is. They fit the definition. It was appropriate for the judge to give that instruction and leave it up to the panel to determine if they agreed with that. It's important for the court to, in citing this granted issue, to compare the proposed instruction prepared by appellant to the instruction actually given by the military judge. And in doing so, the court can see that the essence of what appellant wanted was included in the accomplice instruction. The requested instruction stated that Sergeant Rafferty and Mr. Nunez testified in exchange for leniency, and that, as such, their testimony should be treated with great care and caution. This is what the military judge instructed the panel when he gave the accomplice instruction, and he gave both parts to the accomplice instruction, the entire instruction, not just the beginning part, but he gave the entire accomplice instruction.
Well, counsel, why wasn't it error for the military judge not to give the bench book leniency instruction? Obviously, he gave a variation of the bench book accomplice instruction. There's no argument there. But the bench book also has a standard instruction on leniency, and it says that whenever a witness is testifying under a promise of leniency, this instruction should be given, and there is in fact a subdivision of that instruction that said this part should always be given. This is mandatory. So why wasn't it error for the military judge not to give that instruction?
It was not error, Your Honor, because what was conveyed to the panel, it may not have been in form in the bench book that you're referring to, but the exact points that needed to be made in that instruction were raised in the compass instruction. So appellant received what he should have received. Again, it may have been a different format to some degree, but the heart of the matter, the essence of what needed to be instructed, made it to the panel.
Well, why then does the bench book have separate instructions on leniency and accomplices?
There could be instances, Your Honor, where a person may be testifying who is not actually an accomplice to the offense of the person that the accused is being charged with. In that event, in leniency instruction, obviously they have to take the place of the compass instruction, so there could be variations where the compass instruction is not going to apply, so you need the leniency instruction, obviously, to convey the points that need to be made.
So where an accomplice is receiving leniency, it's your position that the bench book leniency instruction need not be given because that's covered by the accomplice instruction?
It was not error in this case, Your Honor. So what the judge had told the panel in the compass instruction was that the panel can make the decision, are the accomplices, Mr. Nunez, Sergeant Rafferty, and other individuals, if they felt that they were accomplices, then they were cautioned that accomplices often testify in order to achieve leniency. And as such, accomplice testimony needs to be treated with great caution. looking at the Gibson test, which articulates whether or not an instruction given to a panel is substantially similar to the instruction that was being sought by the accused, appellant can meet none of the three prongs articulated by Gibson. The correctness of the proposed instructions, the first prong of Gibson. Appellant's proposed instruction was factually inaccurate. In it, he stated that Sergeant Rafferty and Mr. Nunez were testifying in an effort to lessen their charges, which was not the case. They're being charged with offenses that they had in fact not, that they had in fact committed, but not some lesser offense. Yes, Your Honor.
They're not being charged with as many offenses as they had admitted committing. There is a reduced number of charges that they're being charged with. So in that regard, there was a reduction, wasn't there?
Sergeant Rafferty is being charged with
one
charge
count
involving greater than $100 figure of theft, which was a comparable format to the charges that appellant was being charged with. The important difference in the dollar figure, so it would have been brought out in court.
Well, he admitted that he had stolen on lots of occasions, and he's charged with one count, while the defendant in this case is charged with multiple counts for stealing on lots of occasions.
Yes, sir.
Can't that be construed as a reduction?
Your Honor, I think what the appellant was trying to convey in his proposed instruction was that not that the counts were, or the charges, the number of charges was being lessened, but the charge itself would be different. A lesser included offense, for instance, which was factually inaccurate. That's not what was happening. It was also factually inaccurate to say in the proposed instruction that they were testifying in order to lessen their sentence. So at the time, again, the sentence was speculative for any of these individuals going to federal court. And only one individual, the federal judge, can make a determination what was the appropriate sentence. So that was also factually inaccurate. And as such, appellant fails the first prong of the Gibson test.
Would you explain again why that's factually inaccurate, that they were testifying in order to lessen their sentence?
Oh, okay. Yes, Your Honor.
If, as Judge Erdman suggested, there could have been a charge against Rafferty for multiple offenses, which would have had 10 years times the number of offenses or whatever the sentencing guidelines would apply for that. Mm-hmm. And instead, he's only going to expose himself to a maximum of 10 years by entering into this plea agreement. Why isn't the plea agreement reasonably read as an effort to reduce his sentence exposure?
Well, Your Honor, at the time, no charges had been filed against Sergeant Rafferty, so it's somewhat speculative to say, you know, with any certainty that it would have been this one charge. So we don't know because it had not occurred yet at the time of the court-martial. As far as the charge that was being contemplated being brought against Sergeant Rafferty, it was inaccurate to say that his testimony would have lessened his sentence because there was nothing the government and Sergeant Rafferty could agree to. It's a federal judge's decision as to what the appropriate punishment is. Turning towards the substantial coverage, the second prong of the Gibson test. As I've articulated, the essence of instruction that appellant sought was given with accomplice instruction. Looking at the third prong of the test, the damage to the defense case. The Civil Defense Council had ad nauseum made the point about bias with all of these witnesses. Appellant was able to bring that defense, and he was able to argue that defense as effectively as he could have. But it cannot be said that his case was damaged by him being deprived of the ability to raise a particular defense. But even if the court is to conclude that there was error on the military judge's part in not giving this instruction, whatever error there was would have been harmless. There is abundant evidence of appellant's guilt, And the defense counsel had argued leniency effectively through the cross-examination of the witnesses and during his closing argument. So the point about leniency and why the witnesses may have been testifying was before the panel. Subject to any further questions, I will conclude briefly. Appellant's conviction and sentence should be upheld as the petitioner's sentence being, or Sergeant Rafferty's potential sentence was speculative. An issue of bias was raised extensively with Sergeant Rafferty. Further, the essence of the instruction that appellant wanted was in fact given by the military judge. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
Your Honor, the ultimate issue here is bias. The military judge failed to allow the defense to show the members the complete picture of their witnesses' bias. He curtailed the cross-examination into the details of his plea agreement. This left the members without all of the evidence that they needed to properly weigh Sergeant Rafferty's motive and credibility. And that, in fact, Sergeant Rafferty was currying the favor of the SELSA, the assistant trial counsel, who was sitting right in front of him as he testified. This deprived the appellant of his best defense based on that bias and the credibility of Rafferty. This court can find that this may have tipped the balance in favor of the appellant. Now, the military judge also failed his duty as the gatekeeper of the trial by refusing to give both mandatory and requested instructions to the panel. Now, the government said that the witness said that a witness with leniency might not always be an accomplice. Now, I would argue in the alternative that where someone is an accomplice doesn't necessarily mean they're testifying under a grant of immunity or leniency, which in fact was the case with Sergeant Rafferty. Now, this incomplete picture left the panel members, or the members, without the guidance, the proper guidance that they needed to know how to evaluate Sergeant Rafferty's testimony in the full light of his bias and his plea agreement. And this court should set aside the findings and sentence in this case.
Thank you, counsel. We thank counsel for both parties for your argument today. That concludes our arguments for this morning and for the month of November. And the court will stand in recess.